People of African descent have been under surveillance since before the founding of this nation. An early form of surveillance was born out of the desire to control and exploit others. Now I'm specifically thinking about the enslavement of Black people. In addition to patrollers, also called paddy rollers, one of the many ways Africans, enslaved and free, were surveilled was through the use of slave passes and free papers, respectively. These were documents needed to guarantee that the movement of a Black person was authorized. Yet, while surveillance has changed over time, it is still a mode of control and exploitation. We are all under some form of surveillance now, and new technologies have transformed capitalism and the carceral state. This includes a variety of new tools and techniques. Smartphone technology in general, racial records classifications, risk assessment algorithms, DNA testing, carceral GPS tracking, racial profiling apps, the use of AI, artificial intelligence, and the social media surveillance of Black Lives Matter activists. So there is a national expertise in not only tracking the thought and movement of Black people, but also the ways in which surveillance pushes the community into constricted physical and digital avenues and areas of increased control. Related to this idea, I recall a trolling event in the early 1890s. In 1893, Lee Walker, a Memphis, Tennessee laborer, was scheduled to be lynched for supposedly attempting to assault two white women who were on their way to town. A white mob quickly formed, tracked Walker down, and forced him into a jail cell. The day before they lynched him, dragging him out of his cell, the Memphis Public Ledger newspaper sent a telegram to Chicago requesting that Miss Ida Wells, the well-known and outspoken Black woman anti-lynching crusader, be sent down to Memphis to write about Lee's pending murder at the hands of vigilantes. Make no mistake, this was next level trolling in the 19th century. This is Dr. Catherine Bankole Medina with The Invention of Racism. The goal of this podcast series is to share the subtle and not so subtle nuances of racism from the past into the 21st century. Understanding and speaking the truth about racism is the first step toward combating and ultimately eliminating it. This episode, A Good Deed and the White Supremacist Online Surveillance of Black People, is a personal narrative and reflection of an experience that I blogged a little about. Most of the narrative is exactly the same as the blog. First, I will give a brief introductory statement about the shape of racism. Then I will relate my own experience with digital racism online. And third, I will provide some recommendations for books and articles dealing with the surveillance of Black people. By way of introduction, as we all know, the spectrum of anti-Black racism is on full display in the year 2020. Remember that the unending macabre theater began in the spring and included a white woman weaponizing her privilege and her faux fear against a Black man who was bird watching in New York City's Central Park. Also remember the police execution of yet another Black man in Minnesota, of course, George Floyd, which set off yet another wave of worldwide Black Lives Matter protests. Then there was the white woman in Florida who killed her 9-year-old autistic son and then blamed 2 fictional Black men for the crime. Also, the Louisiana police officer who commented on Facebook that it was unfortunate that more Black people did not die of COVID-19. And the effort of politicians to attempt to nullify the Black vote in predominantly Black and democratically held cities in our 2020 presidential election. We really could go on and on. However, these are just a few of the many openly racist incidents that permeate the United States in 2020 and highlight pandemic racism. I have a 2-part podcast on the basics of pandemic racism, so make sure you check out episodes 12 and 13. Pandemic racism refers to the disproportionate number of Black and persons of color contracting and dying from COVID-19, and simultaneously, the escalation of local, state, and national racist events, including harassment and violence, designed to further traumatize and oppress Black people. If you study United States history, you know that we are living in a cloud of racist nostalgia, a reboot of the immediate post-enslavement world, where the central theme of Southern society from 1865 through 1877 was white racial redemption at any cost. It was and is a potent, psychic, and apocalyptic idea, right? That Black freedom somehow meant enslavement for white people, and thus Black freedom was an actionable threat. We know that white supremacy is structural and systemic, and as such, much larger than the work of usual suspects associated with racist social movements. And I'm talking about the alt-right, neo-Nazis, the Klan, racist neoconservatives. Those who uphold a generic white nationalist hegemonic ethos. Contemporary anti-Black racism has a foundation, and it is about how our neighbors, proximate people in our communities, the places we live and work, routinely weaponize and deploy their sense of white privilege. So, as I begin, my question is, in the prolonged battle to defeat a racist, redemptionist backlash, what responsibility do we have to our neighbors? Now, I'm telling this story because a little more than 9 months ago, I was perusing one of those neighborhood apps. People on these kinds of apps generally share innocuous ideas about how to improve the local community. They do things like swap vegetable seeds and announce garage sales. You know, they just want to sell stuff that they no longer want. My casual appearance on this app was long before any state or national pandemic social distancing guidelines were announced or enacted, and before masks were required anywhere in public. Remember, at this time, they were still debating whether masks, then subject to a PPE shortage, should be allowed for ordinary citizens. They said at the time only healthcare workers actually benefited from the use of masks in fighting COVID-19. Now we know much better now. Anyway, 9 months ago, my state had just begun advising that groups of no more than 10 people meet in enclosed spaces. I logged into this app only a few times over about a 3-year period, and I observed all kinds of community discourse, including racist attacks for no apparent reason. Yet mostly, I checked out the app to find out about such things as power outages and road closures. So on one rare early spring day, months back, I logged onto the neighborhood app and saw that a woman on the app, and let's call her Sue, said that she was looking for someone who could provide in-home services, like personal assistant services for elders. She indicated that she was in desperate need for help around the house. I knew a woman working in this field who told me that she needed some extra income and was looking for new clients. So in one brief sentence, I recommended her to Sue. Another woman on the app, we're going to call her Jane. Jane also jumped into the thread. Clearly she was a businesswoman. And she posted almost immediately to Sue that she could provide any kind of in-home service that she wanted. I never gave the suggestion another thought. Then I got a notification. In one moment, I was just an ordinary citizen trying to help a random neighbor and a friend. And then suddenly I became something else. Imagine my astonishment when a third woman on the app, and yes, I have to call her Karen, entered the thread. Instead of offering help or insight, she threatened to call the police. Karen threatened to call the police on me because I had provided a reference to Sue. Now, everyone in this scenario is visibly and undeniably white, except for me. And not only did Karen name me and only me, she said she would call the police immediately if I continued to make such recommendations. Just as important, she wanted me to understand that she had family and friends among local law enforcement officers. In my book, World to Come, I've called this intimate coupling of private and public law enforcement deployment as militant racism. Without any additional encouragement, Karen went even further. She told me that they could easily look up my home address and other social media and personal identification information. Apparently, she vehemently disagreed with the gathering of 10 people suggestion by state government. However, instead of contacting state and local officials about her concerns, she lashed out at me. She was ultimately triggered by my Black woman persona and the audaciousness with which I equally shared digital's public space with her. The modern racist ethos contends that Black people are supposed to know that all the spaces are racially colonized, and this includes online and real-world spaces. The point is, people like Karen position their whiteness in an attempt to intimidate, control, contain, punish, and even harm Black people. Karen signaled her neighborhood app base and the police that I was a serious problem, an open target for the white supremacist impulse. She weaponized her sense of entitlement and eagerly put my life in danger. She confirmed that some white people will always leverage their perceived personal relationships with law enforcement to corral an assumed Black threat. You know, it never occurs to them that law enforcement will not act out a specific white supremacist ritual and script against any Black person. Earlier, I asked the broad question, in the prolonged battle to defeat a racist, redemptionist backlash, what responsibility do we have to our neighbors? We know what this responsibility is, ideally, morally, ethically, we know. But the real question is, who is a neighbor? It has been said that the racist mind does not respect or care for us as a people, as neighbors, which of course, while clearly an understatement, is a basic construct and consequence of racism. More accurately, racists don't fear us, though they may claim to fear the black body to justify their actions. They don't see our culture, our agency, or our power. They do fear the strength of our political influence, which accounts for the ongoing voter suppression and disenfranchisement campaigns. Yet, in this country, if racists saw black people as fully self-determining and formidable citizens, we would have different kinds of exchanges. Racists don't fear black people in the autonomous sort of nation-state sense. They treat us like we are stateless people who are beholden to the largesse of the established order for our very existence. And thus, certainly racists don't fear the consequences of their actions when discriminating against or harming us. We are not perceived as neighbors. So let's breathe for a moment and just mention a few solutions. White and people of color allies often want guidance from us on how to proceed. First, read, discuss, and take responsibility for racism. Second, understand white privilege and make a commitment to safeguard justice. I met a white woman recently who donates substantial amounts of some of her service fees to black and people of color causes as a private form of reparations. I don't know where she got this idea from, but she doesn't broadcast this. She doesn't boast about it. She just does it. Third, there are urgent causes everywhere. So show up early before the hour is near, not after we have fought the battle. Fourth, don't engage in performative social justice. For example, it is not enough to say, I understand racism and my white privilege and I am sorry about that, and then do nothing to create equitable anti-racist spaces. Fourth and finally, speak up, stand up, and give up any pretense that this is anything other than a cycling of racist history. Ida B. Wells Barnett said allies need to give up their tacit encouragement, their silent acquiescence. She wasn't wrong. What about African descendant people? I have just one main point here. Black people need to harness, enhance, and command our sense of, for example, eliminating the impulse to attack and or diminish one another, especially among people who are already with us. You can't constantly admonish certain black people and yet fail to offer a clear solution or even a word of denunciation for those actively and aggressively engaged in our oppression. This practice offers an immense tool for racists to exploit, and there is nothing more satisfying to the psychopathic racial personality than witnessing the public turmoil of black people constantly struggling with each other over material, physical, and intellectual spaces and places controlled by racist rubrics. And yet, there is so much more we can do right now to bring a humane sense of order to racist chaos. As African descendant people, we too can choose to be more human. We can live up to our ancestral legacy and fight back. We can continue to build and support our businesses, institutions, and organizations. We can resist and protest. We can practice radical self-care with each other. We can write about, document, and record racist and anti-racist events. We can learn and teach. We can inspire. We can disrupt and hold accountable social and political systems that are not working for us. We can support one another. We can demand racial justice. We can support people who are truly doing something meaningful to advance the cause of racial justice. We can do what we must do. We can hold racists accountable for their actions. Referencing Ron Walter's important work, White Nationalism, Black Interests, this situation with the neighborhood app falls under the category of and intersects with the idea of unofficial and official power. As many scholars and activists have said, racists don't really fear black people at all. They are, however, desperately frightened by the very notion of losing white supremacist power. Pay close attention to the historical and contemporary surveillance of black people. And there are so many good books and articles and film projects on the subject. However, relative to this podcast, there are some timely, scholarly, and popular articles about the Nextdoor app that have appeared over the past few years, including Raheem Kurwa's Building the Digitally Gated Community, The Case of Nextdoor. There's also Katie Lambright's Digital Redlining, The Nextdoor App and the Neighborhood of Make Believe, and Nisa Ahmed's Why I Quit the Nextdoor App, The Cesspool for Racist Gentrification. One compelling social and political history I recommend is George Derek Musgrove's 2005, The Harassment of Black Elected Officials, Race, Party Realignment, and State Power in the Post-Civil Rights United States. And you can get the 2012 revised version of this book, which documents how the surveillance of black elected officials and presumed black radicals has evolved. I also think it is very important to understand government and corporate surveillance by studying Shoshana Zuboff's The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, The Fight for a Human Future at the New Frontier of Power. More than a century before, we honed modern forms of state surveillance. Anti-lynching activist Ida B. Wells Barnett was harassed, threatened, and her movements were tracked. Wells Barnett started her career as an educator and a journalist in Memphis, Tennessee. As editor and co-owner of the Free Speech and Headlight, she documented the lynching of black people and challenged the specious yet oft-cited excuse of sexual assault. In 1892, when she speculated about the interracial sexual indiscretions of white women who charged rape, she was widely condemned and called a black scoundrel, and a lynch mob attacked and destroyed her newspaper while she was out of town, which forced her into permanent exile. White citizens said they would kill her if she came back to Memphis. When the Memphis Public Ledger newspaper sent that telegram to Chicago, it was not just an invitation to a reporter to cover Lee Walker's public murder. It was also bait in the effort to get her to attend her own lynching. Wells Barnett, of course, ignored their trolling and the not-so-veiled death threat. She courageously fought against lynching her entire life. To be clear, Ida B. Wells Barnett wrote that threats cannot suppress the truth. Thank you for listening to this podcast. Support for independent podcasts like The Invention of Racism is critical at this moment. In the national and global effort to dismantle racism and to establish human equality, we need as many thoughtful and courageous voices as possible. If you believe in and appreciate this anti-racism podcast, continue to download, like, and share and support us all around. I also encourage you to use your own media platform to honestly analyze, examine, and to put an end to racism. And if you are listening to this podcast series, then you already know. Discourse on racism is not for the faint of heart. I hope that you will continue to join me as I present key topics in The Invention of Racism.